Oh,
all over the place.
All over the place.
You get tangled up in them, pull them over accidentally, all kinds of things.
Okay.
Set. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 Om ajnana timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshur unmilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajevam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanto Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Brindavaneshvare Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpatriubhascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pabanebhyo Avaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Is a very often quoted verse also. Chanchalam himana krishna pramati balabhadridham tasyaham nigraham manye vayor iva suduskaram. For the mind is restless, turbulent, and obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, I think, is more difficult than controlling the wind. For the mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it, I think, is more difficult than controlling the wind. This verse is actually kind of a striking verse because it talks about the mind. Before I actually break into a discussion of this verse, I first of all want to thank you all for coming and your interest in Bhagavad Gita and what it might have to say for us even in the modern day. And Bhagavad Gita was written down some 5,000 years ago. And it's the description of the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna just before the Battle of Kurukshetra. And if you've been here all along, you maybe remember that back when we first started the Bhagavad Gita, this is chapter 6 now, but in chapter 1, we had this understanding that Arjuna is about to face a major battle, and he's deciding that he actually thinks it's a bad idea, that the battle should not be fought. And he has his reasons for it. The main reason, of course, is, though Arjuna doesn't make that reason plentiful, the main reason is that Arjuna does not want to fight some of his relatives that are on the opposite side. It's one thing when you're fighting a battle against people you have no connection with and you don't know. But it's another thing when you're fighting a battle against people that you're actually very acquainted with and in some cases have great respect and love for, which Arjuna certainly had for Bhishma Dev, who was like his grandfather practically, and for Dronacharya, who was their martial teacher, the person that taught them how to fight. So both of these people are on the other side. I think Arjuna didn't have so much love lost with Dhritarashtra, although he mentions it in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. They had always been at odds with one another. But Arjuna thinks that the battle will be bad because they're fighting people that he has close affection for. And as a result, he's a little bit worried about the battle. And of course, he makes these things... That's all right.
You got it. Made it a little tighter.
Yeah, okay. He's had affection for some of the people on the other side. And he explains to Krishna that he's not going to fight. But he doesn't just say it as flatly as that. He says, but I'm confused and I do not know what my duty is. Please, you instruct me. So then Krishna begins to instruct Arjuna. And from chapter 2 all the way through the last chapter, chapter 18, we will have this discussion about what Krishna says to Arjuna. We start with Arjuna asking Krishna to tell him what's the right thing in this situation, and he's prepared to accept what Krishna says. But at the same time, he makes his pronouncement that he doesn't want to fight. And then we get to chapter 18 towards the end of it, where Krishna says, now I'm prepared to act according to your instructions. So Krishna does fight. Historically, we find out that the battle does go forward. And in fact, the battle will be devastating, and practically everybody on both sides will be dead at the end of the battle. But Arjuna is convinced to fight by what Krishna says. And Krishna isn't just giving him a pep talk to engage in a battle. He's actually explaining to him the situation of life, about dharma or religious duty, about occupational duties. He's talking about the nature of the soul and the cycle of reincarnation. And he describes many things about especially the process known as bhakti yoga, the process of devotion. So all these things are explained by Krishna in the course of the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita is kind of broken up into three major sections, which I'm bringing up because we're about to the end of one of the sections. And since there are 18 chapters, it works out kind of interesting that the Bhagavad Gita is basically in six chapter blocks. There's the first six chapters, the middle six chapters, and the final six chapters. The first six chapters, Krishna is describing various Vedic possibilities to Arjuna. In six chapters, he describes various Vedic possibilities. And toward the end of the sixth chapter, this is the sixth chapter we're talking about right here, Krishna gets around to actually stating his real preference. So before that, Krishna is saying, well, there's this, and then there's that, and we can think about this, and we can talk about that. But finally, by chapter six, at the very end of it, Krishna does not leave it up in the air. He does not leave a myriad of possibilities, and Arjuna is free to choose whichever one he thinks is appropriate. Krishna states a definite precedence, or preference is the word I'm searching for, preference. And that happens at the very end of chapter 6. You are not quite yet at that stage yet, here at 6:34. We haven't quite gotten to that. But the last two verses of chapter 6 clearly spell out what Krishna really wants Arjuna to do. And then with chapter 7, we actually begin to hear about bhakti yoga in detail, no longer kind of vacillating on whether maybe some other Vedic path is maybe more important or possibly relevant to the situation. At that point, we start talking directly and specifically about Bhakti Yoga, which is the middle six chapters. So first six chapters is kind of a review of all Vedic possibilities, finally getting around to Krishna stating a preference. Middle six chapters is that preference now showcased, Bhakti Yoga, what it is, what it isn't, how one processes or performs Bhakti Yoga. And then the last six chapters, we return to some of the other elements of the other paths, and now we discuss them in a way to shine more light on the path of Bhakti. Now, I've given some classes here, and I've mentioned this point before, and I keep mentioning it because without this point, it's often easy to get very confused about the Gita. But before I launch into that, let me ask the question, because I like to stop every short bit and ask if anybody has any questions about what I just said in this very first section about the Bhagavad Gita being broken into three chapters, about Arjuna being confused about his duty and Krishna speaking, and about the idea that the first part of the Bhagavad Gita kind of details various different processes. Anybody confused about that or have a question about it? If not, then I'll go into the next little section here. Okay, so
Can I ask a question, Marsh?
Yeah.
It was at the very last thing that you said before you asked if you have any questions. So you said that the topics discussed in the last six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita shed light on Bhakti Yoga. So I was just asking, in what sense do they shed light, or how do they shed light? Meaning, they show how different activities that one can do that may be part of the other Vedic processes, that they can also be applied within Bhakti Yoga.
Yeah.
And how to,
That's basically, and that's just about what I'm about to launch into
here.
But I appreciate your question because it segues into what I'm about to say. Well, if there are any other questions, then I'll move on. Yeah, you have a question about it. If what within the Gita
encapsulates
one of the 18 chapters, that would be the essence of the Gita.
Yeah. Bhagavad Gita, I think, is a very difficult book in many ways because Krishna really kind of gives you a tour de force at the same time without a lot of elaboration of all of the most important essence of Vedic literature. It's 700 verses, you know, so if you go through the 18th chapter and you add them all up, it's 700 and not 701 or 609, it's 700 verses. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, by comparison, is 18,000 verses, so that's much, much, much bigger. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, all these details that Krishna kind of touches on in Bhagavad Gita are expanded much more in greater detail. And so what the Bhagavad Gita does is it gives you a capsule summary, which is all fleshed out in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and all the details are there. So oftentimes when people just read the Bhagavad Gita, they may seriously be bewildered about what it's saying or what it's regarding. But if you've read a lot of Vedic literature, particularly if you're familiar with the Srimad Bhagavatam, then you'll find the Bhagavad Gita makes perfect sense, and it's kind of a summary of all Vedic information, although it doesn't elaborate in many cases on many subjects. Does that kind of answer your question, or did I kind of beat around the bush and not get there? Okay. So.
Sorry.
Yeah, you have a question.
A really quick question. Yeah,
good, okay.
Thinking about Krishna and Arjuna being on the battlefield, and it seems like a short span of time that they're having this conversation.
Yeah.
So why would, in your opinion, why would Krishna start off explaining all the other processes and not just jump into, hey, this is what you got to do right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's another topic I had planned to discuss.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, I don't have any problem with that. I can discuss it right now because it's probably an appropriate time for it. Then I'll start launching into the larger thing, which Atma brought up. But the point that you raised is a quite good point, and people might wonder, why is Krishna going through these details if he doesn't actually intend for Arjuna to accept these processes? And the answer is quite, it's a twofold answer. One of them is that Arjuna is a product of Vedic culture. In other words, Arjuna didn't grow up in a vacuum. He grew up, interestingly enough, although he is a prince and although he's the son of Maharaj Pandu, the Pandavas grew up in the forest, which means that Pandu, unlike many rulers, was not one of these office kind of guys. You know, he didn't like sitting around in the palace and managing things. He wanted to be out in the kingdom. Particularly, he liked to be out in the forest. It wasn't just that he liked nature, but that in the forest there were a lot of sages. And in the forest, he could be with those sages and learn about spiritual life. And there was not so much confusion from being in the, you know, kind of hustle-bustle of a palace and all these kinds of things happening. He was able to have the time to sit down with sages out in a natural setting and ask them questions, which naturally the Pandavas did as well when they were growing up as little kids. So they heard these talks of the sages. And, of course, they heard many different viewpoints of the Vedas. And naturally, from hearing many different viewpoints of the Vedas, you come away with this idea that it's a potpourri, a whole assortment of various kinds of processes. And whichever one kind of rings to you, that's what you should do. And that's generally the way many people even today see Vedic knowledge. The Vaishnava tradition does not see it that way. But to understand what the main focus is, one has to have a guru. And up till that point, Arjuna does not have a guru. And at that moment, he actually, in second chapter, accepts Krishna as his guru. Before that, they see each other as friends. But after that, Arjuna is seeing Krishna and putting him in a different perspective. He's seeing him as his guru. And now Krishna's describing the real purpose of the Vedas, because Krishna knows the Vedas. In chapter 15, we hear he's the knower of the Vedas, he's the source of the Vedas, and he's the goal of the Vedas. You know, so we haven't gotten that far, but that's in chapter 15. So Krishna is just touching base on all these various possibilities in the Vedas so that he and Arjuna are on the same page when he finally launches into what he really wants Arjuna to do. Because by that point, we won't start backtracking and Arjuna will not have a question like, but I thought jnana was like this, or I thought karma was this. I thought Sankhya was more important, you know. So Krishna is kind of giving him a tour de force, around the world in 80 days tour of all the Vedic things. And then he finally brings it into what he really wants Arjuna to do, so that now at this point Krishna has paid his bit of information from, in chapter 2 we hear about Sankhya Yoga, what's usually called Sankhya. We hear about Karma Yoga in 3 and 5. We hear about Jnana Yoga in chapter 4. We hear about Dhyana Yoga in chapter 6. So these are various Vedic formulas, and now Arjuna has kind of heard Krishna touch on all of them, and now Krishna is finally stating his preferences. And now with chapter 7, Krishna will not talk about them as if, well, maybe they're all equal, or maybe they're all equally important, or whichever one you do, go for it. Krishna's not speaking that way anymore. At chapter 7, he begins to speak about bhakti yoga, and he's very definite about it. So does that answer your question?
Yes, very nicely.
Okay. So back to Atmanivedana's thing, which I want to talk about right now, is this idea that there are many Vedic systems. And originally, all Vedic systems were designed to help you understand Krishna. That's their original purpose. But we see that as Kali Yuga started, Kali Yuga came in approximately 5,000 years ago. This knowledge became gradually teased away or separated from its original fundamental purpose, which was to reveal Krishna. So then we have what appear to be other Vedic paths which seem to have a different purpose, and they seem to give us a different sense of where we're going to. And this is part of what has confused Arjuna. And this is natural. And so I try to keep making this point because it gets a little confusing in the beginning. Sometimes when Krishna is speaking and he uses the word yoga, he means Krishna yoga, the original purpose of yoga, which is to reveal Krishna. And sometimes when Krishna is using the word yoga, he means the mundane path of yoga, which is now the kind of separated version of the original yoga that has earned its own niche in Vedic society and seems to have a different purpose than the original yoga did. Now, not only is it yoga that does that, we could talk about jnana, or the path of knowledge. There is the original purpose of knowledge, which is to understand Krishna. Now, there is a path of jnana, a mundane path of jnana, where people learn various Vedic formulas, they study various obscure Vedic texts, and the purpose of that study is to gain some mystical realization now, or some realization that it's all one. This is all called the path of jnana, or we'll call it here the mundane path of jnana, as opposed to Krishna jnana, which is knowledge directly of Krishna. At one time, all these things, yoga, jnana, sankhya, and so forth, these were all just different ways to understand the process of self-realization. They were not different things. They were just a different conceptual framework to understand one thing, and that is Krishna and our relationship with him. But over the course of time, as Kali Yuga came in, each of them took on a life of its own and gradually diverted away from the main concept, which was to reveal Krishna. And that's why today people are very confused about these things. And it looks like it was even happening even during Krishna's time already. There was a sense of the original purpose of the Vedas seeming to blur into a number of different paths, which didn't seem to be the same thing or the same way of talking about the same subject, but in fact seemed like different subjects with different goals and different processes. So when we talk about Ashtanga Yoga, or the Eightfold Yoga Process, the original purpose of Ashtanga Yoga, or the Eightfold Process, was for one to be able to meditate and see the Supreme Lord within the heart chakra, and then one could become fully absorbed in the Supreme. And that was the original purpose of the Ashtanga Yoga system. But now we find that people who are yogis or Ashtanga yogis, they have many different ideas of what yoga is for. Just like people who are jnanis or following the mundane path of jnana, they have different ideas of what knowledge is supposed to give you. And so there are also people who are tapasvis or people who are renunciates, or we could say ascetics. They engage in very difficult mortification of the senses. And originally, those things were designed to reveal Krishna. But now people engage in mortification of the senses for other purposes or other goals. And we also have this idea of understanding God or Krishna through the process of developing love for God. So sometimes people can abstract this also to a mundane level. And instead of developing love for God, we hear stories about God and we fancy that we are God or we should do the same thing God does. And so this just shows that when they're understood in their true essence, they are not different things. They are just different ways of talking about the same thing. But when misunderstood, then they appear to be different paths leading to different goals. And that can be done with yoga, with jnana, with tapasya. It can be done with yajna or doing sacrifices. All these things have taken on apparently a life of their own, a life which is not so directly connected to understanding Krishna. So when we talk about any of these things, sometimes we have to stop and ask ourselves, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about the original Krishna yoga, the original Krishna karma or activity? Are we talking about the original Krishna jnana? Are we talking about the original Krishna yajna, doing things for Krishna? Or are we talking about the more peeled off, diverted, mundane path of yoga, mundane path of jnana, mundane path of yajna, mundane path of renunciation? All these things have a life of their own. And so in the first six chapters, Krishna is trying to unscramble Arjuna's understanding of the paths of the Vedas. And he finally emphasizes that he wants Arjuna to engage in the path of bhakti. So, again, I want to stop. Any questions about that? It's a little difficult to grasp, but if you have a question, please ask, and I'll try to see if I can elucidate it. Maybe I'll have to use different words. Yeah.
I don't have a question, but I just really wanted to thank you because you've answered questions I had from years ago about when they differentiated, did they all have the same goal, and they don't. And I
There's a historical, you know, thing here that around the time Buddhism came, you know, say 500 BCE, you know, or maybe before that, depends on what you want to accept as what kind of historical authority about that time. Buddhism was coming into India, and the various Vedic teachers felt the need to codify their various understandings and in response to Buddhism. And by that time, they were actually writing various things. And some of these different paths became, even at that point, literarily set up at that point because they were responding to Buddhism. And now down the road, we see that it appears that there are various different paths and there are various different goals and all that kind of thing. So we're much more late than that. But apparently it was even going on 5,000 years ago, even at that point. So again, if we understand the real purpose of the Vedas, then we're whether talking about yoga, or we're talking about sense control, or we're talking about mind control, or we're talking about jnana, or we're talking about karma, we're talking about the same thing, we're just using different words for it.
Well, I didn't have a question until you brought up Buddhism, Maharaj.
Okay.
That's really a big issue, but years ago I was a Buddhist, many years ago, but I've always had this question, just because I have incomplete knowledge and only read a verse somewhere, left me just hankering for, it was about Shankaracharya, it's a quote from Lord Shiva speaking to his wife, Parvati, and he was explaining how he has come to mislead.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was so confused, and except in my little mind, I could just think of separating the wheat from the chaff, and like, who is really interested in God and who isn't? But I have so many Buddhist friends, I still do, and it's the wrong path. You know, I mean, I found that out when I met my first devotee, and I went, okay, I get it, and I quit. But why? Seems like such a farce. I mean, I don't know if that's the wrong word, but it seems like mass confusion.
Well, there's a purpose to it.
Or is it the wrong time to ask to expand?
Well, let me see if I can give you a Reader's Digest version, because it definitely could expand into a 45-minute discussion, and I'll try to fight my tendency to take it that direction. So I'll give you a Cliff Notes version of it. That basically, everything happens for a purpose. And people have different desires, and that's why people are attracted to different kinds of philosophical and religious organizations or traditions, because they have certain things that they want or certain things they don't want, and so that's kind of what sifts things out. Buddha was actually also sent by Krishna, and the reason Buddha came was to put things back on the right track again. Vedic literature had been misinterpreted for many hundreds of years by the brahmanas and had fallen into the state of creating a lot of animal slaughter, you know, and these Vedic sacrifices that were supposed to be done, not often, but they were supposed to be done for elevating various beings to higher planes of existence, that had degraded into a wholesale slaughterhouse industry, you know, that they were doing these things for the purpose of eating the animals. So Buddha came to put a stop to that. So he rejected the Vedas. And Krishna wanted that, you know, that he put a stop to that. And we see, if you study Buddhism, there's so many parallels, because like Christianity gets born out of the Old Testament or the Judaic tradition in a similar fashion, Buddhism gets born out of the Vedic tradition, so you'll see many, many similarities. But there's some striking differences, too, and that is there's no talk about the soul, no talk about God. So Emperor Ashoka, now we're talking about, you know, 30 or 40 years before Christ or something like that, he does for Buddhism what Constantine does for Christianity. He makes Buddhism the state religion of India, or he very much makes it very important for people to learn about Buddhism. And some of the Vedic knowledge and some of the Vedic practitioners go underground, but in large, many of them just transfer over to being Buddhist teachers. And that goes on up until Shankaracharya, which is, again, another one of those historical dates that people quibble about, somewhere between 9th century and somewhere maybe as early as the 6th or 5th century, at least Shankaracharya's people say that. So somewhere in that time, that's when we have Shankaracharya coming, and his purpose is to put faith back in the Vedas. You know, Buddha took it away, although he taught things that were basically Vedic, but he just divorced it from the Vedas. And now in Shankaracharya, he came a much later, more like, you know, well, I say somewhere between the 6th and the 8th century. And he begins to teach Buddhism, but he teaches it from the Vedas so the people don't have to struggle to make such a big change. And in fact, in a short time, during Shankaracharya's own lifetime, which was long, but still, Shankaracharya manages to essentially re-evangelize India for the Vedic tradition, and people, for the most part, stop being Buddhists. Buddhism becomes a minority, but it leaves India and becomes part of the rest of the Orient. So it enters into, you know, China and the areas of Thailand and all those places where it still is today. So he did not teach what the Vedas really have a meaning for, but he taught something that was compatible with Buddhism in such a way that people could accept the Vedic tradition now and not have to change again very much. And it was not until the Alwars, you know, now we're talking about the 10th century, 11th century, 12th century, we get you know, Ramanujacharya, and we get, you know, Madhvacharya, finally, who come and put the real purpose back in the Vedas. So I knew that would take me too far out of the way, but anyway, that's a quick kind of view of it. There's a purpose to it, that the Vedic knowledge is now once again back with us, but now we're divorcing it from the animal sacrifices that originally were such a problem with it way, way back. And now we have people teaching the Vedas the way that they originally intended to be taught. But we still have many things that lag over from both the Buddhist tradition and from the Shankaracharya tradition. So some people want to be aware of only a certain proportion of the absolute truth, so they get that in the form of a philosophy which gives them a portion of what's right, but leaves out a significant thing. And at some point in their evolution through many different lifetimes, they will see the need to go beyond that, and then they'll segue over into a higher understanding. So maybe it was too long of an explanation.
Not at all. I wish I could have a private conversation with you.
All right.
So many questions.
All right. So, any rate, the thing that I was really focusing on here was this idea that there are different paths, or they appear to be different, but at one time they were one thing. But be careful when you read Bhagavad Gita to recognize when you're seeing the word yoga or the word karma or the word jnana or whatever it is Krishna, is Prabhupada talking about the mundane path of, or he's talking about the original Krishna yoga, Krishna karma, Krishna jnana, all these kinds of things, that they were directly related to Krishna. Okay, any other questions about that? All right, so chapter 6. Yes.
So are you going to be talking about, are you planning to talk about, coming up now, the differences between the, you know, the Krishna yoga as you characterized mm-hmm. it and the mundane one? Mm-hmm. Is that part of your plan?
Well, not so much. I had planned to go a different direction, but what I wanted to do was just to make the simple point that if you're talking about yoga, and the purpose of yoga is to understand Krishna, then it's Krishna yoga. Otherwise, it's the other kind.
No. Okay, so in other words, so can I just ask a follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So in other words, like, for example, so since we're on Dhyana yoga, the sixth chapter, so just looking at that yoga, not going into the Jnana yoga and the Karma yoga, but for that one. So in other words, the Krishna version of it compared to the mundane version of it, they both entail following the same processes up until a certain point when you either are interested in meditating on the Supreme Lord or not. And then also the other difference between the two is that the motivation of the person who's engaged in the non-Krishna conscious version of the Jnana Yoga is that he's not interested in focusing on the Lord in the heart, even when he's in the beginning stages of that yoga process.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the person who understands Jnana Yoga properly, even before he's reached the stage of seeing the Lord in the heart, but he's practicing some more beginning steps like the do's and the don'ts kind of thing, the mm-hmm. habits, he's doing that with the goal that one day I will be able to control my mind and senses and see the Lord in the heart.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much.
So, yoga is a tricky word because in Sanskrit, it basically, in its most generic form, it means to unite. It's the same word that comes down to us in English as yoke or union. It comes from the same basic cognate. So when we're uniting with something, what are we uniting with? In a plain vanilla general sense, all those things are left open. But when Krishna uses that word, oftentimes what he actually means is uniting with him. And how do we do that? Through service. So that's the idea of yoga. But there's other, in Sanskrit, there's a lot of other synonyms for the word yoga, which mean anything from doing some mystic practice. It can mean that without regards to whether it has anything to do with Krishna or not. It can also mean the Ashtanga yoga system, which is what usually we think of when we hear the word yoga, particularly the one piece of it, which is Hatha yoga. Usually when in the Western world we hear yoga, immediately we think of the yoga of, you know, doing various exercises. But that's only one version of it. And even in Sanskrit, the word yoga can mean tricking people. You know, like if you were, in some situation and someone did some sleight of hand or did something crooked, you know, then you would say, oh, this guy is doing some yoga, you know. So it has that connotation as well. So generally we don't mean those kind of connotations, but in the larger picture, whenever we hear the word and it comes to us from Sanskrit, we have to kind of pare away which thing we're really talking about. So in chapter 6, Krishna actually outlines this dhyana yoga system. You know, the reason he does, again, is because Arjuna has in the second chapter, in the first chapter, said he's not going to fight. He's indicated that he actually wants to go to the forest. Now, why would Arjuna go to the forest? Ostensibly to perform yoga and meditate. And so Krishna in the chapter 6 is saying, okay, Arjuna, this is what you're thinking you might do. Instead of fighting, you're going to the forest and you're going to meditate. Let me tell you what this process means. And in chapter 6, you know, all the way from about verse 10 through verse 32, I believe it is, from verse 10 to verse 32. What's that?
11, I think.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Krishna describes to Arjuna the details of this process. Sitting down on a kusha grass, staring at the tip of the nose, controlling the breathing, you know, he talks about the nuts and bolts of yoga. And this is, of course, the Ashtanga yoga system. And the Ashtanga yoga comes from two words. Asta means eight. Anga means limbs or eight parts. So the Ashtanga, or eight-limbed yoga system, has eight parts, yama and niyama, that's the first two parts, that nobody does, except for people who have actually studied the Vedas in India. But we usually start with stage three, which is hatha yoga. That is what we see all around us. In many places, they teach hatha yoga. And that's step three. Before step three, you should go actually through yama, niyama, which is accepting various kinds of daily activities and dues in your life to increase your ability to do yoga, and also rejecting certain things in your daily life that actually are detrimental to yoga. So those two things happen before the stage we call hatha yoga. And then with hatha yoga, one does what we commonly see, perform various kinds of physical exercises, and those are designed to purify the energy channels or nadis in the body. And once those become purified, then one is able to sit in one position for long periods of time without discomfort. And then when you do that, then you can brings you to step four of the Ashtanga yoga system, which is pranayama. And pranayama is the breathing part of yoga. So we learn how to breathe in a very specific way. And along with breathing, we learn how to slow our consciousness down, because consciousness is connected to the life airs. And there isn't just one kind of air, the one that comes in and out of the body. I think there are six major ones, and then literally dozens and dozens of minor ones. And by learning these air channels, one can control consciousness. And that brings you to stage five, which is pratyahara, where one is able to control the mind in a very basic way. And then the rest of it beyond that becomes very technical. I don't have the time to get into it, and I haven't really studied it in that great a detail, but we have, after pratyahara, there's dharana, and then dhyana, and finally samadhi. So all these stages. And at the samadhi stage, you're supposed to come to the point where you're visiting the chakras in the heart and in other places in the body. And specifically, you come to the heart chakra and you meditate on the Supreme Lord there. That was the original purpose of the yoga system, the Ashtanga or Eightfold Yoga System. This was described in the Vedas, and this was actually the proper path in the age known as Satya Yuga, which was a long time ago. It doesn't work anymore in this age because we don't live long enough, and our bodily airs are too disturbed, and we live in a culture where we have so many amplified material desires that for us to reach the Supreme Lord by meditation within the heart is very, very, very unlikely. So it's not recommended. And this is the Ashtanga or Ashtanga yoga system. And Krishna has described to Arjuna the Ashtanga Yoga system, and when he does, immediately after describing it, this is Arjuna's reaction to it. And that's the verse that we have today. Chanchalam himana krishna pramati balavadritam tasyaham nigraham manye vayori vasudhuskaram. That the mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong. And to control it, I think, is more difficult than trying to control the wind. So Arjuna is speaking 5,000 years ago, not in Kali Yuga, but in Dwapara Yoga. He thinks that it's impractical. And the verse before that, he even says it in those words, that Arjuna said, O Madhusudan, this system of yoga you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me, for the mind is restless and unsteady. So Krishna goes through these verses from 10 or 11 all the way up to verse 32, describing this Ashtanga yoga system, and that's Arjuna's reaction to it. He says that this system appears impractical and unendurable. And then he says, because the mind is restless and obstinate and cannot be controlled very easy. It's like controlling the wind. So, of course, in the next verse, Krishna says it can be done, at least controlling the mind, not necessarily performing Ashtanga yoga, but controlling the mind can be done. We'll see if we get to that far this today. But at any rate, I wanted to kind of put this chapter into perspective. This chapter deals with the idea of Ashtanga Yoga. That's discussed in this chapter. It deals with the idea of controlling the mind. And this chapter also, at the very beginning, again, Krishna tries to get Arjuna to recognize the difference between giving up action and giving up the fruit of action. Both of those things seem similar, but they're not the same thing. Arjuna is supposed to give up the fruit of action, not give up action. And again, I'm going to stop here and ask any questions, any issues there or confusion. Yeah.
So, I think I have two questions.
Okay.
The first one is, does that mean that because if ultimately the whole point of Srimad Bhagavatam is glorification of Bhakti Yoga, does that mean that the superiority of Bhakti Yoga was not valid for Satya Yuga?
No. Okay. But once again, this brings me back to the same point I made a few minutes ago, that when we're talking about the original forms of all these things, then essentially they're just different ways of talking about the same thing, how to get to Krishna. When we're talking about them as separate mundane paths of such and such, then we're talking about how they kind of go different directions. So in Satya Yuga, the Yuga Dharma, which is what we call it technically in Sanskrit, the easiest way to connect with the Supreme Lord in that era was to engage in this mystic yoga process. And it was explained. It was an oral tradition at that time. It was not written down in books. Later on, Patanjali actually wrote it down, the yoga system. But that was much later. That's in Kali Yuga. But before that, back in Satya Yuga, it was an oral tradition, and people would meditate, and they could actually see the Supreme Lord in the heart. And that's what they did with that process. It's not that they couldn't have done bhakti yoga. In fact, that was a type of bhakti yoga, because the purpose of it was to see the Supreme Lord. And so you see what I'm driving at here? That this is why we get confused about these things, that when we're talking about the yoga system back in Satya Yuga, nobody did it then for material benefit. Back in Satya Yuga, there were no big cities. People did not have technology. They didn't want it. There wasn't even a need for government back then, because people lived very simply and they lived for long periods of time. And so the only thing they did with their time was meditate and try to become more spiritually aware. And so the way they would do that was through this yoga system. And the only reason they would do it was to unite with the Supreme Lord, which they could do by meditating on him within the heart. So that is a kind of bhakti yoga. But now when we talk about it from the perspective of Kali Yuga, we're talking about the yoga system, which, what's wrong with the yoga system? And this is a simple answer, that the modern view of the yoga system, and by modern I mean, you know, not the year 2013, but I mean modern in the sense of Kali Yuga, which we could even be talking about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. So in that sense, modern. That yoga people use, and as you're drilling the life errors, as you're controlling the senses, and as you're meditating, you become aware gradually that you are developing mystic powers. And so rather than just ignore those and go on to understand God, most people wind up becoming, hey, I never knew this was a fringe benefit of doing this kind of yoga. And we get lost in the mystic powers. I mean, most people are not down with yoga enough to get to that stage, but it is possible. And so they'll never get to the stage of learning about God. Likely they won't even get to the stage of experiencing mystic powers, but if they get to that stage, then, you know, the mystic powers take them down a completely different road. And that's why many yoga teachers, all they teach is either the health part of yoga, or they teach, you'll hear about the siddhis, you know, and you can pay big money and learn how to acquire these mystic powers. And, of course, the question is, do people actually get these mystic powers by paying the money and going through this? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. I think probably not so probable, but at any rate, this is a diversion. So when we talk about yoga and we say that it's not recommended for this age, A, it's not recommended because as a type of bhakti, it's impractical in this age. B, if you try to do it and you learn about it from people who are doing it in this age, you'll learn the mundane path of yoga, which will take you down the wrong road. So just as jnana takes you down the wrong road, if you're learning the mundane path of jnana, so the mundane path of yoga will take you down the wrong road. And the mundane path of karma will take you down the wrong road. And the mundane path of sankhya will take you down the wrong road. You know, so all these were can be bhakti yoga or Krishna versions of it if we understand them the proper way. But in the modern day, they tend to be separate competing paths, and we go down the wrong road with them. Did I answer your question, or just made it worse?
No, you answered.
Okay. Okay.
And then if I could add one more question to that. So then if the Ashtanga Yoga system could be a form of Bhakti Yoga because it reunites you, reunion with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it then that what one understands at the ultimate goal of Ashtanga Yoga is Paramatma realization?
That's right.
Which isn't that subordinate to
Bhagavan
realization?
Yes, it is. That gives you what we call the rasa of shanta or neutrality. Mm. So that's the lowest of the rasa. But it is, in fact, considered a rasa, and it does actually give you entrance into the Vaikuntha worlds. There's higher things than that, but that's why it's considered bhakti yoga, because it does in fact reveal the Supreme Lord. Of course, we're talking about it in Kali Yuga, which means that practically no one's qualified for it. And secondly, people who might start out that way might get diverted by the mystic powers involved. Okay. Yeah.
So I was going to ask exactly what he asked. But so went back in Satya Yuga, though.
Yeah.
And you lived, what is it,
100,000 years.
100,000 years. Is everyone just meditating? Then they're actually just meditating on Paramatma? Because that is just the neutrality.
Well, you're working at meditating on Paramatma.
What about Bhakti service? I was curious.
What's that?
What about devotional service? Even though neutrality is the first one, is the base one.
Right.
Don't
Well, that's the issue with neutrality. In one sense, it is considered devotional service because you are meditating on the Supreme. In another another way, it's considered inactive devotional service. Right. So that's why it's considered the lowest of all the rasas.
And yet, Kalan Maharaj is just so highly revered, I don't understand why it's...
Well, that wasn't what he did.
I thought he was, it was the neutrality.
I don't believe... Really, if you can find a source.
Serving Lord Nishingani, Dasya.
Yeah, at least it must be Dasya, you know. If you can find me a source, I'll...
Shankya, what's the name for the Shankya?
Right, Shanta is neutrality, Dasya is servitorship.
No, I meant Shanta, I thought it was Shanta. I read it, I could be wrong.
Okay, well, do me a favor, find a quote, find the source, and I'll take a look at it if it indeed says that. I would be really surprised if anywhere in any of Prabhupada's books Prahlad Maharaj is given the rasa of shanta or neutrality.
You know why I can't find it? I read it 2 years ago. My book's from California.
I see. Okay.
Some, like,
okay.
Anyway,
okay.
So
we'll...
always puzzled me why, because he was so wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I would bet that at least he's in Dasya Ras, you know.
Because also there's Lakshmi and Nrisinga.
Right, right. So Shanta is usually yogis and only yogis, you know.
Right, okay.
Okay, so I don't want to divert the whole thing too much from any other questions about that part of it. Yeah.
Question. When you say that people tend to go in a different route, go down, I fail to understand that because I don't have bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. I try to get bhakti, but I don't get bhakti. And I've tried it really hard.
okay.
But I'm agnostic. I don't understand why would it lead to a bad path or bad destination. Why would it be a different path? Because the idea is you don't realize God and then start jnana yoga or like any meditation. You don't realize God to meditate. You mm-hmm. meditate to realize God.
That's right.
Yeah, you go down the path of knowledge to realize God. So if I'm taking the fruits out of the action,
mm-hmm.
like Krishna suggested, and okay. say, you know what, I'm just going to try this. I'm going to give my full effort in, say, meditation or knowledge. If I'm just going to go down the path, why is that wrong, or why would it lead to a different
well result? Everything has to have a direction or a goal, you know, and when you start out something, what your goal is going to make a big difference, you know. As Prabhupada used to say that if you go to the airport and you buy a ticket for Detroit, you know, you actually wind up on a plane for Duluth, then you know, you're not going to wind up in the same place. So the idea is that we have to see that this whole material world is about cycles, about going around and around and around and around in circles. There's only one thing in this whole world that doesn't go around and around and around and around in circles, and that is devotional service. It's on a straight line, and it takes you out of the material world. Otherwise, you're welcome to do any of those other things, and you'll go around and around and around and around in some cycle. If you become a jnani, you know, you study and you think about all kinds of philosophical ideas, and you keep thinking about them, and you'll always find that somebody will come up with new ones, and you can continue to think about them, and you can think about them. You can die, and you can reincarnate, and keep on thinking about them. But you'll be going round and around and around. You can be a yogi, and you can perform yoga, and you can get to the stage where you develop mystic powers, mm-hmm. and you can meditate, and then you can amaze people with the mystic powers. You form an entourage, and then usually something bad happens. But then you die, and then you can become a yogi again. But you have not left the cycle of reincarnation. You can become a karmi and do all kinds of Vedic rituals so that you become wealthy and prosperous, and you can become wealthy and prosperous, and then you may have the issues that everybody has even if you're wealthy and prosperous, and then you die and you become wealthy and prosperous again, and again you go round and around and around and around. But the only one thing that takes you out of the cycle of reincarnation is to connect with Krishna in love through bhakti. Now, you don't start out with pure bhakti, and that's not what we're suggesting. Nobody starts out with pure bhakti, but it's deciding which hospital, or it's deciding which remedial process you're going to commit yourself to. So, do you want to commit yourself to the process of jnana? If you do, then you're going to get a certain result from that. If you commit yourself to the process of bhakti, you're going to get a different result. If you commit yourself to the process of yoga, you're going to get yet a different result. So the question then is always, what result do we really want? And if we want the result of getting out of this cycle of reincarnation, going back to the spiritual world, where we have a relationship with the Lord in perpetuity, it always exists, it exists forever, then we need bhakti yoga. Otherwise, any of these other things are just as fine. It's just a toss-up, you know. If you really want to stay here in the material world, then some like this, some like it that way, some like it in the pot 9 days old or whatever it is, you know. There's all these possibilities, you know. Does that make sense?
I do have a follow-up on that, though.
Oh, okay.
But if I practice karma yoga and I do whatever I'm supposed to do, and I realize God, it serves the same purpose.
Well, the question is, how are you realizing God by karma? What is bhakti yoga, anyway? What makes it different?
Well, my very... my understanding might be very, very... limited in this, but with bhakti yoga, whatever you're doing in service of God. With karma yoga, I'm taking the fruits of my actions away from my actions. And I think that's, I've said this many times, that that's one thing I love about the philosophy of the Gita, is that it's just fabulous. And it kind of like reduces stress level. Kind of like can be implemented in all walks of life. That's my karma yoga. And that way I'm never disappointed, but I'm always engaged and in my action, and I love the process of, say, going to work or like, you know, cooking. But if it doesn't turn out good, and that's fine, I'll still eat it, but I'm not disappointed. And I kind of feel that psychology works, and that process can lead me to a state of mind that is not deterred by other disturbances.
That I understand that, and it's probably correct what you're saying, but the question is, where do you go ultimately?
Wherever it takes me. Because we don't.
Well, that's what I mean. Therefore, you're leaving the goal up. You know, it's just like turning the engine on in the ship and you're not watching where the steering wheel is pointed. Yeah, you can go any kind of where. And what you will find out is that you'll go round and around and around and around in the material world. If that's what you want, go for it. We don't recommend that. There's problems with that, you know. I mean, anytime you take birth, you're going to have to go through another death. Anytime you come to this material world, there's always all those fun things that we read about in the news every day. Birth, death, old age, disease, and death. And the further antics of Miley Cyrus. And, you know, these are the things that we read about every day. Do we want to experience them over and over and over again, you know? So, anyway, bhakti yoga is, and we find out about it two verses away from the verse we have today, we find out it is nine things: Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmini Videnam. So there are nine activities that make bhakti yoga bhakti yoga. Shravanam, hearing; Kirtanam, chanting; Vishnu Smaranam, remembering the Supreme Lord. Those are the first three. Then we have Dasyam, becoming a servant to the Supreme. Dasyam, Vandanam, offering prayers. And Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam. Archanam was one I left out. Archanam, offering worship to the Supreme. And then we have the last three, which are elevated forms, which are Sakyam, becoming a friend to the Lord, Dasyam, which is becoming a servant, and Atmini Videnam, giving up everything to the Lord. So these are nine types of devotional service. And what we try to do as practitioners of bhakti yoga is we try to fill up our lives with segueing from one kind of service to another. Sometimes we're hearing, sometimes we're chanting. So shravanam, kirtanam, shravanam is hearing, kirtanam is chanting, padasevanam is becoming a servant. So we're serving the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. We do some kind of service. We clean, we cook, we bring things, we talk, we do various things. This is what's called padasevanam. Then archanam, we do puja to the Supreme. Vandanam, offer prayers to the Supreme. Dasyam, archanam, vandanam. What's it? Dasyam, but there's one.
Padasevanam was the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, okay, I already talked about padasevanam. Right. Vishnu Smarnam was one I forgot. That's why I was.
Sorry.
Yeah, Vishnu Smarnam, remembering the Supreme Lord. And then we have those elevated forms, Dasyam, Sakyam, and Atmini Vidhanam. Dasyam is becoming a servant, Dasyam. Sakyam is becoming a friend, and Atmini Vidhanam is giving up everything to the Supreme Lord. So this is what makes bhakti yoga bhakti yoga. These are the principles behind it. And if we're moving between these nine different flavors or manifestations of bhakti, then our consciousness will be bhakti yoga. And at the time of death, we will either go back home, back to the Supreme Lord, or we will be put in a position where we will be much more likely to go back home, back to Godhead in the next birth. So we'll make that process. However, if we prefer yoga, then we can take birth again and again as various kinds of yogis with various kinds of mystic powers. If we prefer karma, then we do all kinds of things, all kinds of occupations, whatever catches our fancy from lifetime to lifetime, and we keep going around and around. If we prefer Sankhya, then we study various aspects of the material world like the scientists do, and we come back and always realize that there's yet more things to study that we haven't thought about yet, we haven't been able to discover yet, and we can go on doing that forever. If we want, you know, instead tapasvi, we can become very austere and give up many things, and we come back again as another kind of austere ascetic. And we get various kinds of boons from that. People look up to us. We may become very powerful as a result of that. And again, we just keep going round and round. So this is the one thing that's different than with bhakti, and that is that we're trying to make Krishna the center of everything. We're doing it in a structured way, not in a random way or in a haphazard way. We've got a technique or a method, and we're doing that. And this technique or method will guarantee that we'll be purified. And if we don't go back home, back to Godhead, at least we'll be in the position where next time or very soon we'll go back home, back to Godhead. Otherwise, there's, you know, millions of lifetimes. And Krishna doesn't force us to go back to the spiritual world. If we like it here, we can stay here as long as we want. We can stay here millions of births. It's up to you, you know. Then you've got to deal with birth, death, old age, and disease over and over and over again, you know, because that's what this material world is. It's not a utopia. It never will be. Sometimes it gets very nasty. In fact, it gets nasty quite often. And we get caught up in that. And people who are a little bit progressive can realize, I want to get out of this nastiness. And there must be another place. And there is. And that's the spiritual world. Any other questions?
Then I'm ready to go now. But I will not land there, but I, and at least I know where I want to go.
Right, right.
And I would have liked to go.
I had it earlier in the chapter. Krishna tells Arjuna that for one who controls the, who has controlled the mind,
yeah,
the super
mind
soul
is, the
is already reached.
Yeah.
Which actually means that, you know, if you flip it around, right, the super soul has to be reached before you can control your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, something like that. The idea is that one of the main topics of this chapter, as we said, was the yoga system. We've kind of dealt a lot with that, and we've come to that. And this question Actually, it's not a question. It's kind of a statement that Arjuna makes. He kind of blurts it out after Krishna describes this process of yoga, which is actually very tedious and very difficult, is about controlling the mind. And first Arjuna says in the previous verse, 6:33, he says that this idea of yoga that you've just described to me, Krishna, seems impractical and unendurable. And then in this verse, he says, for the mind is very restless, turbulent, obstinate, and difficult to control, and to control it is like controlling the wind. So this goes back to the first of the chapter, the sixth chapter, where about 5 through 10, around in 5 through 9, 5 through 10, around those verses, Krishna is describing the need to control the mind. You know, and that's where your verse is that you're talking about, where Krishna says the mind is the best, can be your best friend, it can also be your worst enemy. And then we hear this idea that for one who controls the mind, a super soul is already reached. I think that's in that part. Maybe it's later on. Yeah. So this brings up the other topic that I want to cover tonight, and that is mind control. Of course, you know, we're not talking about mind control in the kind of Frankenstein sense or the, you know, usual sense that many people take it. But mind control is something that everybody does. It's just a question of what are they controlling their mind towards, you know. When a student studies in college to get a degree, they could just, you know, gaga it out on the internet and spend all their time, you know, going to parties, in which case they're going to fail all their, you know, curriculum, and they're not going to get any kind of degree. So they're controlling their mind away from doing things that are very comfortable for the mind or very gratifying for the mind, and they're putting it on something that's austere, usually their studies, you know, whatever their field of study happens to be. So this is a kind of mind control. And this is really, in one sense, very key to Krishna consciousness. And yoga, when we talk about it from the Sanskrit or the Vedic point of view, implies two different things that usually we don't think about that are connected with yoga. One of them is mind control. The other is sense control. And mind control and sense control, these things are very closely aligned, and they're very closely aligned with yoga. Though in the modern day, if you mention yoga and you tell people, did you know that yoga is about sense control or mind control, they would certainly not make that connection. They wouldn't figure out how those things are connected. But they're connected in this sense that if we don't control the mind will control us. And in this verse, and in the next one, the one that we're talking about today, this is kind of a long about answer, but I'll see if we get there. We find that Arjuna is telling Krishna that he thinks the mind is uncontrollable. However, Krishna rebuts him with the next verse, which is 35. Lord Krishna said, O mighty arm, son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and detachment. And that's, I think, your question. It is possible. Supersoul is already reached. We can reach the supersoul by controlling the mind. And how do we control the mind? Here Krishna says, suitable practice and detachment. Of course, that's a nicely vague-sounding explanation. But Prabhupada gets a little more specific with it if you read the purport. And Prabhupada ties it directly to the 9 processes of devotional service. That's what Prabhupada mentions in the purport there, that what we mean by suitable practice and detachment is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmini, Videnam, these 9 things. That's what we mean by suitable practice and detachment. And that's how we control the mind. In other words, we can't stop the mind. That's what the yogis try to do. But we see that to do that, you have to go through this huge rigmarole that we're not qualified for. It is very difficult. But we can do it by constantly engaging the mind in thinking about Krishna in some way or another, directly or indirectly, through hearing, through chanting. I'm getting a cramp. Through hearing and chanting, through remembering Supreme Lord, through offering puja, or what we say is worshiping, offering prayers towards becoming a servant, becoming a friend, and giving up everything. So these are ways that we can keep the mind always on Krishna. It's not the same as the yoga process, and it's not the same as the meditational process. It's a different process. But it accomplishes the same thing that the yoga process does. It accomplishes the same thing the meditation process is. More importantly, it accomplishes the end result of controlling the mind. So we are sometimes chanting, sometimes we're hearing, sometimes we're reading, sometimes we're doing some service, sometimes we're offering prayers, sometimes we're offering some kind of puja to the Supreme. And in all these cases, we're moving from one thing to another, always thinking about Krishna. And in this way, the super soul is already reached. What do we mean in this case? The super soul in the form of Krishna is connected with, and Krishna is telling us what we should do. If we can actually stay on that platform 24/7, we are out of the modes of nature. We are 100% in contact with the Supreme Lord. Problem with that is that that's a high calling, and likely we're not there. But we can certainly get there, and we can certainly head in that direction. That's what we can do, and that's what we should do. And the more we can do it, the quicker we become aware that this whole material universe is really a kind of virtual reality for us to try to once again reawaken to the Supreme. Does that, maybe I said too much there. But anyway, anybody have any questions about that? I want to kind of elaborate on that a little bit more, and then I'll kind of finish up. But any questions on the idea of controlling the mind or controlling the senses? If we control the mind, we can certainly control the senses. If we don't control the mind, we'll never be able to control the senses. Because before the senses go for something, the mind went for it. You know, so that's how we set ourselves up. You have a question. Before you, Joan, I wanted to, she had a question.
You got a question.
She had a question.
I sometimes, as it's a personal question, I sometimes find myself controlled by my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a struggle between my mind and my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I ask for guidance on how to, like, just silence, because sometimes it's too much for me to handle. And I ask you, actually, what I've meditated a lot on it.
Well, the thing that we talk about is the process of chanting Hare Krishna. And so we did that a little bit. We do it musically, but we also do it non-musically. We have beads, and we have this mantra. It's called the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And yeah, and we chant a full mantra on every bead. And then there's 108 beads on a string. And so by the time you've chanted the whole mantra on each bead, then you've chanted 108 times. That helps us to quantify how many times we chant. Now, as we're chanting, we are trying just to hear the sound vibration of the mantra. And this drives out other things. And of course, if you actually try this, you'll realize it's not easy at all. And the reason it's not easy at all is because there's a thing in Sanskrit called samskaras. That means that as we've lived through many lifetimes, we have developed patterns of action, patterns of desire, and habitual patterns of thinking that are etched into our consciousness. They're not really a part of the brain, they're a part of the subtle body, you know. And so that's why people are so different. And even we come out of the womb very different than one another. It isn't a blank slate. We have these samskaras. And so that's why some people go off the rails in one way and why other people go off the rail in another way. Because we bring this to our present life from past lives, and they're very strongly etched. And then in the course of one life, we tend to, because we're not even aware of it, just amplify the ruts we go down every day. You know, we do the same kind of thing over and over again. And because we do the same kind of thing over and over again, it gets etched into our consciousness even deeper. Then we die, and it's even more, you know, set up in the next time we come out in the cycle of reincarnation. So to conquer the mind by the mind seems paradoxical, and in fact it is. So we don't conquer the mind by the mind. We conquer the mind by Krishna's help through the holy name. So we chant Krishna's name, Hare Krishna, and we try to hear that sound vibration. And by degrees, those deep ruts in our behavior, deep ruts in our mind, are being eradicated. And so those of us who have been involved in this, the process of Krishna consciousness for some time, we take a vow to chant a certain amount every day. You know, many of us who are initiated have taken a vow to chant 16 times around 108 of the beads, which takes approximately 2 hours. You know, if you're real slow like me, more like 2.5 or 3. And all the time you're chanting, you're just trying to hear these sounds of Krishna's name. And you're actually, when thoughts come into your mind, you're just ignoring them, letting them float on by, and again bringing your mind to hearing the sound vibration. And if you do that, you will recognize that your mind has really seriously changed from when you started chanting to when you finished chanting. It's like a mental bath, you know. And it is controlling the mind. But more than that, it's asking Krishna for help to control the mind, because Krishna can control your mind. You can't even, because, you know, the paradoxical thing about the mind is that we discover, like you did, most of us have discovered this at some point or another, that the mind has a mind of its own. It's our mind, but it seems to have a different idea than we do. So what's up with that? You know, it's very strange. But the fact is that our mind has a mind of its own because of our samskaras, the things we've programmed into it for many lifetimes. To erase that, we can do it by the process of chanting. And the more that you give yourself to the process of chanting, the more you'll find that the mind will become peaceful, and that you will. One of the things that happens when you chant is you're shocked by how much total, utter rubbish goes through your brain on an average given square 15 minutes. You know, there's so much stuff that goes through there that's actually completely, utter, pure rubbish, you know. But we're chanting and we begin to realize, gee, I always took this stuff seriously. This is crazy stuff. I better, you know, you begin to realize how you can't take your own mind seriously about a lot of things, because where is it all coming from? You know, it's coming from our past. It's coming from all kinds of places, kind of like a radio receiver. All this junk is coming in there. And most of the time, we just don't pay any attention. We just take it all seriously. We think, if my mind is saying it, I must believe it. I must be doing it. This must be me. But in fact, it's all this, you know, static radio signals from our past, from our conditioning, from other people, from our ambient society. And so that's why we need to clean the mind by the process of chanting. Does that make sense? Okay. Oh, okay. You have a question.
So since it's etched in your mind,
uh-huh,
and you have all these distractions, Are you chanting, would it be chanting to etch it in your mind for the next life until you have reached your ultimate goal?
No, we're chanting to get rid of the conditioning even now. And technically, you will see that it's, you know, it's one of those things that sounds kind of preposterous when somebody says it, that you can change your whole life by chanting. I think the biggest drawback in the chanting process is it just sounds too damn easy. But in fact, it works, you know. And that's why so many people can't take it seriously, because it sounds too easy. It doesn't cost anything. You don't have to go anywhere for it. You don't have to be in a special place. You don't have to consult astrological charts to know when you should do it. You don't have to get costly paraphernalia. You don't have to be dressed a certain way. You don't have to have any of those things. It can be done anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances. And if you're serious about it, you'll see your consciousness will change. That's why I tell people who've never tried it, just try it. But this is the thing. While you're chanting, seriously try to hear the sound vibration of your own voice speaking the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And immediately your mind will jump in there and try to take you somewhere else, and then you just don't allow it. You let it pass on through, and you keep yourself on it. If you struggle hard with it, you will see that your whole mood has changed completely, kind of like being in an airplane. We've had that experience, many of us, that you're flying through the clouds, it's bumpy, it's dark, and suddenly the airplane pops up above the clouds, and it's always shining up there because you're above the clouds now. It's kind of that sort of feeling that you get. And if you seriously apply yourself to the process, not only will it get you out of the present mood if it happens to be not very good, but it will, in the long run, purify you of the bad habits that you have taken with you from previous lifetimes, and even all those special ones that we discovered and decided to work on in this lifetime, you know. So it gets rid of them. It gets rid of bad habits. It gets rid of past conditioning. And it changes your consciousness, because we're really thinking about Krishna. So that's why we're called Hare Krishnas, because we chant Hare Krishna, you know. And if you chant it and you do it in that method, that you're doing it by just trying to hear, you'll see that it will in fact change your consciousness. Does that make sense? Then the next thing is just to give it a whirl, see if it actually see if it actually lives up to its reputation. I mean, I wouldn't be here in it right now if I hadn't started doing it at an earlier point in my life. You wanted to say something?
Question, Maris.
Okay.
So, you know, thinking of myself and also of other people who have, you know, talked to, sometimes it seems like there's someone's already a devotee. They're already practicing Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. They're already chanting, but they may have, there's something about either the way that they deal with others or their habits that, you know, are not quite up to par, mm-hmm. quite up to what they should be. So, and sometimes it seems like, but then they can say, well, but I've been chanting for so long, mm-hmm. so, the chanting is supposed to, so, if one just continues to chant and hear Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, mm-hmm. With proper attention, then even those habits and ways of dealing with others that aren't quite right, even though you've had them for so long, they'll change as long as you hear attentively.
Yeah.
Even if it's only for a limited number of hours during your day, the other hours you're doing other things. Mm-hmm.
So chanting is something we do that not only changes where we are right now, but it changes our life whole course. You know, it changes the direction we're moving in. And it gives you realization of the spiritual world. You know, we live in a time and in a world where people are focused on the outside. You know, we define ourselves by the external world. we've forgotten that there's an internal world. And more and more our society even rejects the idea that there is such a thing as an internal world. We hear all the time that people say, oh, that everything is empirical. We don't know anything. We just know what the scientists tell us, that inside there's no consciousness. There's no such thing as a soul. There's no such thing as God. Some people even go farther and say that there's no such thing as consciousness, that there's no such thing as any kind of sense experience. It's all an illusion. In fact, you know, Francis Crick and James Watson, the famous people who discovered the structure of DNA, Crick said that exactly, that person you think you are, all your hopes and emotions and memories, it's all just chemicals and electricity moving around in your brain. And that's the way he sees it. This is a total external understanding of the world and ourselves. But most of us can see through that kind of limited conception. We know there's an internal world because we feel it, we experience it. Now, that internal world can be just as mysterious as the external world, but through chanting, that internal world becomes actually revealed for what it is. We begin to pipeline through to the Supreme Lord, which all the religions talk about and people have talked about since way back when. But now we're directly connecting to it, you know, not just talking about it. We're connecting to it. And to connect to it, we have to do something. It's not a passive process. It's an active process. And that process is, as we said, these nine processes of devotional service. We do spend a certain amount of our time chanting, and we do other things too. You know, we remember, we hear, we engage in service, we do worship, and we offer prayers. Mm-hmm. Anybody have any other kinds of questions about this? Yeah.
Could you explain what you say it's called vasanas?
What's that?
Vasana.
Vasanas?
Yeah. Is it something to like attachment to like each life when you bring forth? Is that what they call vasanas?
Might be. I've never, to be honest with you, I've never heard the term before, but that doesn't mean necessarily that somebody isn't using it somewhere.
I think that means tendency.
Yeah, like from past life.
Tendency. Yeah, that might be something like that. We do, but samskaras is the more general term for it. It's that sort of, every baby is born already with them, although in the very beginning, because the senses aren't fully developed or fully matured yet, the samskaras really can't make themselves felt in the external world. But when the body matures, at that point, the tendencies of all these past lives become vented through the senses in the external world again. So sometimes that's not so good, you know. And for most of us, it isn't so good, and we have to work at purifying that whole bag of stuff. Okay.
I do have one fundamental question.
Okay, one fundamental question.
This is a repeat question. I keep asking it until I get convinced. God is making this whole process of like He hiding from all of us and expecting us to actually figure Him out and understand Him and realize Him, and kind of make this a very hard game on us. That's a different story. But the whole idea of God itself is like you have to like believe that, you know, this meditation is going to work. I'm going to realize God before you'd even feel that. You know, if you go with a very agnostic view, like I'm not sure if this is going to work, you never tend to realize that. Right? And that's where I seem to have a problem. It's like I can come to a state where like, you know what, I'm just going to give this my best shot. Because I can, because somewhere back in my mind, I don't feel like maybe there is no God. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is a God. I don't know. So there are two parts of this entire statement that I made. First thing is making this whole thing so difficult for us, with leaving no shred of evidence of Him. And the second part is It's the whole idea of like bhakti needs bhakti for it to actually work.
But what was
bhakti
the last?
Bhakti needs bhakti for it to actually work.
Yeah, it does. But not in the sense that you're thinking, I think. This world is a world where we can't know anything definitely on a purely empirical level. You know, there's nothing certain in this world. One thing is obvious is that there's many holes in our understanding of the world around us. It's not immediately apparent how this world got here. It's not immediately apparent what we should be doing here. It's not immediately apparent what's better and what's worse. None of these things are immediately apparent, and they can't be established on an empirical basis. However, all of us at some point decide what seems to be the most likely direction to go. You know, few of us are true skeptics that are so skeptical about everything we don't go any direction. In fact, I don't know anybody that's like that. You know, even the classical skeptics of Greece, you know. We all go in a certain direction. And for most of us, the one thing we're sure about is sense gratification feels good. And so we go for that. And that's a trap. And we, you know, because we see it around us, we see it in the movies, we see it on the billboards, we see it in the subways, we see it everywhere on the internet, on TV, and everything. We are convinced that, well, that's a reasonable thing, that we should just go for making our senses feel happy. And then after a while, we learn that, you know, you get to smoking more, enjoying it less principle, that no matter what we do, by gratifying our senses, it never seems to last very long. We start to get a sense of burnout on it. We want to try something new. And usually we try something a little riskier, a little uglier, a little bit more dangerous. And in this way, we gradually get ourselves into serious trouble. And so Krishna does make this world where he hides himself. He does that for purpose, because if we don't want to know anything about God, God is not going to force himself on us. So, therefore, if you don't want to know anything about God, then God won't come to you. You won't apparently see him anywhere. And for people who demand empiric proof, they're demanding not just empiric proof, but they're also demanding that we don't do any work, you know. I use this analogy, you know, if we were going to say that I wanted proof of the Higgs boson, you know, supposedly some months ago in, CERN, right, in the LHC, they did all these tests and they came up with evidence that appears to indicate there is such a thing as a Higgs boson. Now, if I came to a scientist and said, prove to me that Higgs boson exists. And he could say, well, I said, can you bring one to me? Can you show it to me? I don't see any evidence of a Higgs boson. And he said, well, I can't prove it to you that way, but if you come to the CERN labs, I can show you this, and then I'll have to explain to you the mathematics. And I say, I don't want to learn the mathematics. You know, this is exactly how it works the other way. When scientists or people with an empirical basis come to want to know about spirituality, they say, I want to know God, meaning that you've somehow got to say, okay, hocus pocus, and you push down some special dust and God comes out of a puff of smoke or something like that. But I can actually give people knowledge of God, but they have to do the process involved. In other words, just like if I was going to be someone was going to prove to me the Higgs boson exists, then I'd have to learn mathematics, I'd have to go to CERN, I'd have to look over their records, I'd have to hear the scientific arguments involved. So similarly, if someone wants to know about God, they're going to have to go through the trouble of learning Bhagavad Gita, trying to practice it in their lives, chanting every day. Then they'll get some realization. Otherwise, it isn't going to happen. Otherwise, you can be agnostic about everything. You can be, skeptical about whether God exists, about whether there's any reality whatsoever. But where does that get you? At some point, you try to decide what's the most likely thing that's going to be worth your time to investigate. And that's the one most important decision you can make in your life. What's the most likely thing that's worth your time to investigate? And if you investigate it, especially if it's a spiritual thing, if you're interested in spiritual life, if you're not, you're in the wrong place, you know. But if you are, then we've been talking about it. The Bhagavad Gita says it. The Vedas are there. This has far more detailed information about this world than any other thing, plus a very well spelled out process. It's not vague. It's not guesswork. The process is very detailed and outlined. Give it a try. So that's all I can say. You know.
Thank you. I think the CERN example was fantastic, by the way.
Okay, I'm happy that it worked for you. Okay, so what happens now?
I think we'll do Dhammadas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so everyone can feel edified in Krishna consciousness after this wonderful class?
I do.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. Hare Krishna.